Hello, and welcome to Head Start English. Today, we are in a hotel room on the 12th floor. Yes, it's another poetry special. We are talking about Norman McCaig's classic poem. Not sure if it's a classic, but it's one of his poems. I suppose it's kind of classic. Hotel room, 12th floor. I'm, for the first time in my Head Start English history, I'm joined by a guest. You want to say hello?
Hello.
Yes,
nice
I should have.
Nice to be here.
I should have introduced you before I said that. That was really unprofessional. This other voice you hear is not me doing an impression of, I don't know what your accent could really be described as. This is my friend John, who, like me, used to be an English teacher at the same school I worked at. And I was talking to him last weekend about the fact that I do these tutoring podcasts from time to time. And I mentioned hotel room 12th floor. And we're doing it over Zoom, we're talking over Zoom, and his face lit up at the prospect of, he said it would be like slipping into a comfortable pair of slippers or meeting up with an old friend, because this is one of his favourite poems that he used to love teaching. Am I right, John? Am I exaggerating there slightly?
Yeah, you said at the start there you weren't sure that this was a classic, but actually I genuinely love this poem. I think it's... in terms of being able to talk about and be able to discuss and be able to actually be relatable, I do think this poem is fantastic.
Wow. So obviously you've teased us there that you're going to come up with some really good, insightful comments about this poem. I mean, you've set yourself up here by saying it's one of my favourite poems. I love to talk about it. So We're going to be the judge of that in the next 20 minutes or so while you... are going to regale us. I mean, I did think it'd be quite funny if I said, well, hello, welcome to this podcast. John, talk about this poem for 20 minutes, please, while I sit and drink tea and just watch you. But we're not going to do that, because obviously that would be really, I'd be very one-sided and a bit rubbish. And you've heard me doing this myself, and it's quite hard to talk without anyone to interact with. So this time, normally I've got notes in front of me and I'm sitting reading from them. I just have a poem in front of me, as do you. So yes. I thought this would be quite interesting for anyone listening, just to hear what two teachers, I know neither of us teaches anymore, but we are still, it's in our blood, you know, you're just always, if you cut me open, there's like marker pen and chalk inside there somewhere, because I haven't washed for a while though. So we're going to do what I've done with the other poems, which is basically we're going to read through it line by line, and if there's anything of note, we'll stop and talk about it. We don't have time to sit and analyse every single word in the poem, obviously. But we'll stop if there's anything really important. And if you feel like I've missed anything, you can always say, Ian, you missed that bit, where if there's something you really feel is important that I've maybe skimmed over, please, that's why you're here.
Excellent. I look forward to doing that.
Yeah, it's exciting. Right, so hotel room 12th floor. I'm going to start reading it right now, John, just in case you wonder what's happening, in case you think I've gone slightly doolally, I'm just start talking verse. So here we go. This morning, I watched from here a helicopter skirting like a damaged insect the Empire State Building, that jumbo-sized dentist drill, and landing on the roof of the Pan Am skyscraper. So we're opening up there with a bit of a visual description of what the speaker, the narrator, McCaig, whoever it is talking, what he sees. And immediately he uses imagery to paint this vivid picture. First of all, he describes the helicopter skirting the Empire State Building. He describes it as being like a damaged insect, which is a simile for anyone listening along. John, what do you make of that as a simile, saying that the helicopter's like a damaged insect? What do you think McCaig's trying to make us think there by saying that?
Well, first of all, it's that impression of size, isn't it? You know, a helicopter, if you've ever stood next to a helicopter, they're pretty darn big. But in comparison to the size of the buildings, they're just like small flies, mosquitoes almost even. They're just tiny little insects because they're so small. Also, the buzzing sound as well, of course. A helicopter kind of makes the buzzing sound like a fly might make. So there's the comparisons there. But I think the interesting thing, I think that most times we pick up on, is the idea of the addition of damaged.
Yes.
Because the simile would work just as well by saying a helicopter skirting like an insect. Mm-hmm. We would still got that impression of size, the buzzing, etc. So why damaged? Why throw that in? What's the point of that, do you think, Ian?
Well, it's got a more unpleasant connotation than just... I mean, insects themselves are usually quite... They have quite a negative connotation. There's not many people, yeah, when you talk about insects, they light up with joy and think, oh, insects, what a lovely topic. But the damaged, it has very unpleasant connotations. It makes you think of violence. It makes you think of something that's dying. So instantly, we're getting this impression that this is a poem that's probably going to be dealing with some unpleasant ideas, possibly to do with pain and suffering and violence and death. And then to carry that on, we then have the metaphor describing the empire. One of the best known landmarks in the world, I was going to say in America or in New York, and certainly in the world, the Empire State Building. He describes it as being a jumbo-sized dentist drill, which is a very interesting metaphor. Because again, obviously there's a visual. Anyone that's seen a picture of the Empire State Building knows it does look kind of a bit like a dentist drill.
Yeah, certainly it looks like a drill. Again, it's that concept, isn't it? It would work just as well as saying a jumbo-sized drill.
Yes, but then if you just said drill, you think of like some work person out in the street, yeah, drilling a hole in the pavement. You're like, all right, that's fine. But this is where, you know, as teachers, very often, I know students get annoyed with this when you talk about word choice and the importance of the connotations of a word choice. Damaged with the insect changes it from being just an insect flying about to something that's in pain, it's suffering, it's dying. The dentist's drill, as opposed to a drill, again, makes you think of the painful experience, the unpleasantness associated with going to visit the dentist.
And the fear, isn't it? The fear of the dentist, it's the fear of pain. That's what the dentist is, the fear of pain. Absolutely. And also, you've got jumbo size as well, which we shouldn't forget, because I think one of the key things when we start thinking about Hotel on 12th Floor as a whole is that McCaig wrote this probably in the 60s, I think, 60s, early 70s.
Yeah.
Certainly in Scotland, where Norman McCaig is from, a 12-floor building would have been huge. Your large high-rise flats in Glasgow maybe get to about 12 floors, and that's the biggest. And they dominate the skylines of British, certainly Scottish, but British cities and towns. Whereas he's there on the 12th floor. So in some respects, in his mind, and indeed in our normal lives now, 12 floors is still pretty high for a British building. The Empire State Building is 137 floors high. And that doesn't even take into account the peak, the drill at the top, if you like. And so jumbo size, just given that incredible impression of size that it is. And jumbo size is also that kind of, we associate that with sort of American things. When you see the cups of Coca-Cola that are jumbo sized, that, you know, that we have in America, which we don't have here. It's just that incredible impression of size. But you connect that to dentist drill. A dentist drill on its own is scary.
Yes.
Making it jumbo size just multiplies that sense of fear, that sense of pain, which McCaig is trying to get to us. And it's interesting because we've got Empire State Building in line 3, then Pan Am skyscraper in line 5. And like you say, is they're two of the most famous buildings in the world. Mm. At the given time, two of the tallest buildings in the world, if not the tallest buildings in the world at the time he was writing it. The very depictions of glamour as well. Empire State Building, Pan Am, all of that is glamour. If you think that for listeners, I'm sure probably might not even know what Pan Am is, because I don't even know if they exist anymore. But Pan Am was the world's, at that time when he wrote the poem, the world's premier airline company, which was the very definition of glamour at that point.
Yeah.
And he's undercutting, even though mentioning Empire State Building and Pan Am skyscraper, he's undercutting that sense of glamour by adding in the sense of fear and pain and potential suffering.
So he's very much subverting that common view that people have of America as being this glamorous, enticing, opulent place. I mean, he's recognizing the kind of grand scale of everything, but he's also associating with fear. And fear, as we know, fear is bad because fear leads to hatred. Hate leads to anger. Anger leads to suffering. I don't know, I've got that wrong. Yoda said something like that in one of the Star Wars films. Anyway.
And actually, just very, very briefly, one of the things is that what we've got to remember as well is this is the impressions. What poetry does is gives impressions in a way that novels and plays just don't do. It gives us very snapshots.
Yeah.
And McCaig comes from, wait a minute, I've got this on the screen that I've got here. He came from the West Highlands originally, came from the countryside. He has now gone to this the biggest city in the world at that time. And I remember when I've been to New York a couple of times, and my first visit there, we arrived at about lunchtime on a Thursday or something, and we went out into the street, and it was the busiest thing we'd ever seen in our lives. We actually went into a McDonald's because we were too scared to be on the pavements because it was too busy for us. And I think that's the sense that we're getting as well from this guy, is he's come to this great city and he's scared to death of it.
You just get an, it's like the whole thing just sounds overwhelming. Everything sounds too much for him. I just love the idea of little boy John maybe sitting in that McDonald's having his little cheeseburger and writing a poem about his experience.
Do you know what? Genuinely, I was in my 6 year at secondary school at the time doing
poetry writing,
the equivalent of advanced higher English, and I did write a poem in my time when I was in New York.
Do you still have
not
it?
As good as this one, has to be said. But this is all in the daytime too. This is in the daytime.
That's true.
It's this morning. You can see everything. It should be a safer place, which is, I'm sure, what you were going to lead on to.
I'm about to say, things change even within this first stanza, where we start in the morning, a time of, you know, normally a time of hope, the beginning of a new day. The morning time is the safest time. The sun is just rising. And then we very quickly and abruptly, in the middle of the stanza, without warning, it just switches. It becomes, but now midnight has come in from foreign places. It's uncivilized darkness is shot at by a million lit windows, all ups and acrosses. Yeah, so suddenly we're thrust into midnight. And, you know, the opening of the poem, there was a kind of uneasy atmosphere. Like you said, there was this kind of underlying sense of fear with the descriptions and the senses that he was getting from the buildings. But now midnight's here. We've just gone from, it's like we've gone from 0 miles an hour to 100 miles an hour in 2 seconds. Now midnight's here. It's come in from foreign places. What do you think McCaig's saying there, John, when he says midnight has come in from foreign places?
Well, first time again, midnight, the use of the word midnight, which is kind of like the witching hour, so that sense of, again, evil, fear, pain and suffering. And then it's come in from foreign places, which technically it has, because the sun has traveled, you know, the sun travels across the horizon and dips down behind it. So it does come in from foreign places. I think there's also that sense of the blame for this, the blame for the violence and the fear that exists on the streets. It's not, Americans don't blame themselves. No. They blame it on others. They other it. And if you think, McCaig doesn't go into it in any great detail, so neither should we, but the sense is that, you know, it's other people's fault, be it the fact, and America has been wave after wave of different forms of immigration, you know, from the slaves being brought over, and America has a long history of blaming, you know, Afro-Americans for African-Americans for any flaws. But then you had the Irish who got blamed for everything, then the Italians who got blamed for everything, and even now, Muslim Americans get blamed for an awful lot. And so that there seems to be that tendency that he's reflecting with the foreign places.
And what about the uncivilized? I know this is a bit that you like, the bit where it talks about the uncivilized dark. Uncivilized is good, because the word choice of uncivilized makes us get connotations of wildness. Yes. And again, that sense of fear, the sense of something unfamiliar, something, a man who's come from the Highlands of Scotland, a nice safe little Highland community. This place that's probably been, he's got this idea, this place has been the height of sophistication, but he gets there and it suddenly feels very uncivilized, very wild, almost like he's in the jungle somewhere, and that's terrifying. The uncivilized darkness is shot at by a million lit windows, all ups and acrosses. I know you've got very strong views about that.
Well, again, word choice of shot at, I think we should mention just the idea of the violence, that sense of gun crime.
Yeah.
You know, guns are huge in America, and he kind of puts it in there, shot at. By a million lit windows, again, that sense of, we can imagine very easily that visualness of all those skyscrapers, millions of them, with all lit up across the night sky. Very famous image. And then all ups and acrosses. Now, this is one of those lines that, you know, even as English teachers, we sort of raise our eyebrows a bit at, because...
Yeah. Personally, when I read the poem, before I got this book that I'm holding up to you on my camera, which you and I both have used when we were teachers, when I read the poem the first time, the way I took it, the million windows, all ups and acrosses, I thought, again, it was the idea of scale, the idea of all ups and acrosses. It was almost, again, overwhelming, too much for the narrator to put into words. It's just all ups and acrosses. There's no number to it. So to me, it was the scale of the windows.
Yeah. Scale, you look up, you look up, you look sideways, everywhere, it's everywhere.
All up, all across, everywhere, it's windows. It's the, like you said, it's that overwhelming, slightly claustrophobic feeling of just being surrounded by buildings. Mm. But you and I have both read the slightly more, I don't like to say pretentious, but there is a kind of another way of interpreting that all ups and acrosses, is there not, John?
There is. Well, the visual interpretation of all ups and acrosses, if you even just do it with your hand and just lift your hand up and then across, it's kind of supposed to be that idea of the crucifix, the idea almost of a Catholic benediction that a priest might do, and suggesting that America tries to fight back against this uncivilized darkness by its great belief in God, in Christianity. And, you know, America is a much more religious country than us, far, far more so than we are, and much more open about it as well. You know, the number of times you hear God save America, you know, God bless America, etc. Again, I mean, it's something, if you are writing an essay on it, it makes you sound quite clever mentioning it. But like says, I think if you were just to talk about the scale, like Ian mentioned, I think that gets it across just as much, you know, the power of the...
One of the first images I thought of when I read that, and you know my love for Stephen King, right? Mm. I mean, I'm sitting looking at you, and you can see I'm wearing a t-shirt with Tim Curry's Pennywise the Clown on it right now. But when I think of ups and acrosses, and it talks about fighting the dark, the light, fighting the dark, it makes me think of a book I read a couple of weeks ago called Salem's Lot, which is about vampires. And that image of the cross fighting against the dark, it makes me think of like a vampire hunter, like Van Helsing or somebody like that, holding up a cross, holding up the light of good to face the darkness of vampires. That's the way I looked at it. So that's even more pretentious than the one in the book.
I'm still a bit amazed that you went with a vampire hunter and you went with Van Helsing rather than Buffy. I'm a bit amazed at the fact that you did that, but...
Well, when Buffy fought vampires, she didn't tend to have a crucifix, did she?
No, she just had the stake, didn't she?
Good point. So that's why I said it, because I think back to my childhood of watching the Hammer horror films where Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing would go head to head and there'd be crucifixes involved. Anyway, this is not getting the baby bath.
Yes.
Right?
Stanza two, Ian. Go to stanza two.
So we're on to stanza two already, pretty much halfway through the poem. Very exciting. So, but midnight is not so easily defeated, which is a depressing concept. The idea that the dark cannot be just defeated by religion, light, sticking your lights on. And then we find out how he's trying to escape. He's trying to not escape, but he's trying to blank out what's going on outside. It says, I lie in bed between a radio and a television set and hear the wildest of war whoops continually ululating through the glittering canyons and gulches, police cars and ambulances racing to the broken bones, the harsh screaming from cold water flats, the blood glazed on sidewalks. So we get a little bit of a window into the poet actually sitting there in his hotel room, because he's not really in the poem very much. Normally in McCaig's work, you kind of see him like walking through a hospital or talking about feelings that he has about his aunt's dying and stuff like that. That's for the other poems that they're doing just now. But in this poem, it's very much just things that he observes. But we do get a little window of him there sitting in his hotel room, or lying in his hotel room with a radio on one side, a TV on the other, clearly trying to just block out the sounds that he doesn't like from outside. And that's not working. It's such an overwhelming, unpleasantly loud volume of sound that even having that blasting out in both sides of him, he can still hear what's going on outside, which is, that's the idea that, like, no matter how hard he tries, he cannot escape the sounds of suffering and the unpleasant sounds that come from outside. So it's the idea that, like, this feeling of violence and intimidation is, it's inescapable. It's palpable.
And remember again, we should remember again, he's 12 floors up, which is still pretty high. He's 12 floors up and you can still hear this.
That is pretty high. Absolutely.
Yeah. And I think, and then you go to the wildest of war whoops continually ululating through the glittering canyons and gulches. And this is the first time we really get into sort of Wild West imagery, the sort of cowboy and Native American imagery that kind of is, that's America's sort of founding myth, the idea of cowboys and Native Americans fighting each other. And it's the sort of staple of, they went from a very uncivilized country where cowboys, and I'm going to use the term that we used to use as children, as cowboys and Indians fighting each other. And actually what America did was civilize the country. America as a concept civilized the country, civilized the West, which we'll come back to in a moment. But the wildest of war whoops are supposed to imagine for us these Native Americans going into battle. And I know that Westerns aren't really as popular and not as much a part of people's childhood as they were when we were growing up, or certainly when McCaig is writing. But that way that Native Americans would go into battle and they kind of go, wah, 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 wah. You know, that's the noise you make when you hit your hand against your mouth and just kind of make noises, which is supposed to be the continually ululating thing. Ululating is this sound that the Native Americans would make when riding into battle. But it's continually happening, which means it's nonstop.
Yeah.
And it's nonstop. But the irony, of course, is that the ululating isn't the Native Americans going into battle. That's the sound of the police sirens and the ambulance sirens going to the violence, which I think is quite a, it's quite a clever little irony there, is that the noises that you can hear that are drowning out the television and the radio are the police sirens, the ambulances, because this is what the city really is, certainly at nighttime. It's just violence and violence and violence, and the emergency services trying their best to deal with it.
Again, he's taking something that's either harmless or good. You know, in the first stanza, we had the buildings where he had negative connotations. This time you're taking the sirens of an ambulance or a police car, and he's finding that as a, he's having negative associations with that. I mean, you've got the word choice of wildest to go with the war whoops. Wildest is a superlative there. So it's like, it's the absolute like peak of, he's talked about uncivilized darkness in the first stanza. The wildest, it's like the absolute epitome, the worst, the wildest of the wild that you can think of. And yet this is something that's supposed to be there to protect, to serve, to help. And he's still having negative associations with that as well. It's very interesting. And the language that's quite onomatopoeic, that war whoops and ululating, they are both quite onomatopoeic words as well. Because they make, when you say war whoop, makes you think about that whoop whoop, makes you think of that woo 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 sound that the Native Americans would have used when they were riding into battle with their faces smeared with war paint and their battle axes in their hand. And it's that image is a kind of intimidating one as well. And yet, as you say, bizarrely, he's not talking about people fighting. He's talking about the ambulances and the police who are coming to rescue people, the people who are coming to the rescue, but they sound like the people who are attacking in the Western films. It's very confusing.
It is. And just before we move on, because it's very easy within the sort of narrative of the poem to miss out the line, the glittering canyons and gulches. But again, that's really clever sort of imagery from McCaig of the canyons and gulches were where the cowboys and Native Americans would fight. You know, the valleys and such where they would fight. But they're glittering because, of course, the sidewalks or the pavements and the roads in New York, because they are surrounded on either side by huge skyscrapers, every single street is a canyon. Every single street is a canyon or gulch because they're at the very bottom of this huge canyon with walls of skyscrapers either side of them. But glittering because obviously they're all lit up.
Yeah.
You know, and again, it's that hint of the wealth. There is wealth in the city. There's huge wealth in this city. They're in, but the people with the wealth are at the top of the skyscrapers. they're not the people that are down there on the streets.
And of course, it's quite clever because the canyons and gulches are where the attacks would happen in these Western films. So the idea is that, like, these opulent locations, big skyscrapers, the streets are just as dangerous and wild and unpredictable as the locations of the Wild West films. So it's very interesting. Very interesting indeed.
Am I right in saying that the last three lines of this poem are synecdoche, examples of synecdoche?
They are indeed. When it says, to the broken bones, the harsh screaming, and the blood glazed on sidewalks, they are all examples of synecdoche. And for anyone who doesn't remember synecdoche, or indeed how to pronounce it, some of you might be looking at a word that says synecdoche, and you wonder what we're talking about. It's pronounced synecdoche, which we only found out when we were quite young teachers. I remember, you know how this conversation, that we didn't know this word from our time at school, but it's certainly a thing. So synecdoche is when you refer to part of something instead of the whole. Those of you, if you're listening to this, you've probably done Visiting Hour. Visiting Hour opens with the description of the hospital smell combs my nostrils as they go bobbing along green and yellow corridors. It talks about the nostrils rather than the person to draw attention to the smell. In this case, we're not talking about the victims on the street. We're describing them as broken bones, harsh screaming, blood glazed. It doesn't mention people at any time, but it refers to parts of them. Obviously, all of them are quite negative, focuses on the suffering, the blood, the bones, the screaming. Why else, John, do you think he uses synecdoche there?
I think what he's doing is he's showing that it's almost dehumanizing these victims. Yes. To the emergency services that are running to them, they're no longer individuals. They're just parts of the job they have to deal with. It's dehumanizing the victims because there's so many. It's impossible to individualize them and treat them as each one is an individual victim who needs sympathy and support and empathy. It's just dehumanized them completely. To they are just their component parts. Well, I have to fix the broken bones. I have to stop the screaming. I have to clean up the blood. You know, I don't really care where this blood came from. Yeah. I just have to clean it up now.
It's very effective because it does, as you say, it kind of emphasizes the prevalence of the violence and the suffering. The idea that, you know, where you and I, where I live and where you used to live, where you grew up, if you saw someone in the streets screaming and there was blood all around them, you would look outside and go, oh my God, there's someone out there in a lot of pain and suffering. And most people would look out of their window if they live in a town or a village. They would see that and they would think, oh my goodness, look at that poor person out there. But the idea is that here in New York, it's so common that you're just like, oh, there's somebody screaming. There's some blood. There's some broken bones. They're not even people because there are so many instances. And as we've been told, it's continual, it's never ending, it's a constant cycle of violence and suffering and pain, which is what the initial imagery with the dentist drill and the dying insect, we are now coming to like full circle here to the idea of pain and suffering in the human beings in the streets, and it's indeed a very common never ending occurrence.
Yeah, and just a couple of more little things about that. Cold water flats, they don't have any hot water, they're poor. There's great poverty in this city, just as there is great wealth as well. And then the blood glazed on sidewalks. If you think about pottery or something like that, they're covered in a sort of glaze or paint or varnish or whatever you want to call it. Glazed sort of reflects that fact that the sidewalks or the pavements are covered in blood.
Well, almost, glazed is quite it's like a kind of positive word. It's weird. We've actually gone describing something horrible using a positive word as opposed to describing something harmless with negative imagery. But glazed makes me think of like cakes. It makes me think of pottery. It makes me think of nice like glass that's been blown. You just think of glazing. And yet it's describing something quite horrific. And it's the idea almost, to me, it makes me think as if the blood is almost part of the pavement. You know, when it's like when you glaze something, it then becomes part of it. Like there's so much of it, it's actually just seeped into the pavement. It's become part of its very essence. Anyway, moving on swiftly to the final, very short stanza, thankfully, because we've been going for a bit longer than I think we planned. But, you know, when you start talking about Hotel Room 12th Floor, John, you just can't stop.
Can't stop.
This and Pringles are your two things. Because you do love a golf jumper.
I do.
Right. The frontier is never somewhere else, and no stockades can keep the midnight out. So what do you make of that rather shorter, starker final stanza there?
Well, we're still in Wild West imagery territory here, because the frontier, for just in case you're not aware, in sense of the frontier, when America was first colonized, it was just along the East Coast, and just the East Coast of America, around New York and Boston and these sort of East Coast towns. And then gradually after America became independent from Britain, they began to stretch across the continent. And as they began to stretch across the continent, they began to have more states. And the frontier was wherever the white Western civilization ended. And that was where the frontier was, until, of course, they went right the way across the continent of the United States and reached essentially Los Angeles, I suppose you could say. And then the frontier becomes somewhere else. Yes. Because obviously, if you've colonized or you've sort of civilized all of your entire nation, then where do you go next? And I think it's important to remember that when McCaig was writing this, the Vietnam War was going on, and America's role had changed so that they would go around the world fixing the world's problems. So the frontier is never somewhere else. Well, it's not. They've gone to Vietnam. More recently, they've been in Afghanistan or Iraq, trying to make it better. But what McCaig's saying is the frontier is never somewhere else, because actually, look at New York. It's not civilized. You know, it's uncivilized darkness is there every day. And I think that's a very powerful line.
I think so. It's the idea that, to me, when I read that as well, I think like the frontier, like you said, it's a barrier that separates civilization from some uncivilized darkness. And the idea is that like the barrier between good and evil, between wild and civilization, that barrier is everywhere, right? It's not, you know, obviously at that time, Vietnam would have been seen as the barrier between civilization and non-civilization. But McKagan seeing all this pain and suffering and violence in this place that's reputedly one of the most civilized places in the world, it makes him realize that, you know what, this, the barrier, like, is everywhere. It's almost like the barrier is just, the barrier between good and evil is everywhere. And that is a very powerful realization. And I think having that short stance at the end, it kind of draws your attention to it more. It makes you focus on it. And it does make you stop and think, wow, that's actually quite powerful what he's saying there. Mm. And then when he says, and no stockades can keep the midnight out. Stockades, again, would be protective barriers, if you want to call them that. The idea is there is no protection from the darkness.
A stockade is essentially a fort. The one I always think of is, if you've ever, for some people who are listening might know Largs, and there's a country center called Kelburn right next to it, where as children you would go in, and there's this like little fort which is built with, which got an adventure playground in the middle of it. And that's what I always think about, as a stockade, this little fort with high walls that's supposed to protect you. The skyscrapers play the role of the walls because they're so high and they're lit up, but you can't keep the midnight out because it's already inside the city. It's already there.
So what you're suggesting, if you don't mind, is that anyone that's listening from Largs, when lockdown is fully over, they should go to Kelburn Country Centre and get into that fort and imagine that you're in a skyscraper in New York trying to fight off the darkness. Is that right?
Very much so. Very much so. I think that that's it would help the local economy, and it would also help you with hotel room 12 floor. So yes, as soon as lockdown's over, to Kelburn.
I mean, you should get a chance to go out before you sit your final assessments this year. So you could actually justify a visit to Kelburn Country Centre as studying.
Yep, a socially distanced class trip. Sounds great.
And if there's if there's a swinging on a wheel, that's not really getting to do with it, but it's fun.
Just enjoy yourself.
Exactly, because as we know, the frontier is never somewhere else. So try and grab what pleasures and joys you can from life, guys. Because the frontier is never somewhere else.
Yes, and in conclusion, because I know we need to finish, is that like I say, this poem is entirely, the American dream is the one we've all bought into when we watch the start of Friends or whatever. Mm. It looks like this perfect place where we all want to be. And what McCaig is doing is showing us the reality of the situation. There's a darker underbelly to it than we would ever get otherwise.
Well, it's something that, I don't know if you'll join me for this, but we're going to look at another poem probably in a few weeks' time, I'm going to be looking at Brooklyn Cop again. Mm-hmm. And that's another one that talks about violence and the inescapability and the inevitability of violence in American society. So you can see that McCaig was clearly in a sort of dark place when he wrote this. I mean, not that dark, because there was a million windows going up and down. But metaphorically, emotionally, he was in a dark place as he realised that, you know, he's probably been brought up, like you're talking about, he's seen all these images of American cities and thought, this is the most civilised, wonderful, magical place you could ever go. And then when he goes there, it's not quite as magical. All the lights and fancy trappings are not enough to cover up for the fact that there's lots of violence and lots of scary things. And as he says at the end, the scary things are everywhere. So just be careful, guys. That's what he's saying.
Yes.
So, John, thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
We've gone on. We said we were going to go for 20 minutes. I'm not timing this, but I reckon we must have gone for at least half an hour.
Right.
So,
well, it's a good poem.
It is a good poem. And I'm sure if I asked you to do this again next week, you could probably find more things to say about it. But I'm not going to do that, because I know that time is precious to you.
Yes.
It is. So thank you, everybody, for listening today. John, do you want to say goodbye?
Bye.
Right. Bye, everyone. Thanks for listening.